Yep.
Right. So we're going to be focusing in two books, and half of this is for Erin Craner. She told me to talk on lamentation, so I figured I would. Oh, also, apparently my internet connection is unstable right now, so if I disappear, then it's an act of God. Just kind of a little heads up. I've been reading a lot of, like, Tolstoy lately. So this is very heavily inspired by Tolstoy's A Confession, which is kind of, he talks about his life, how he started off, how he came to church and eventually gets excommunicated by the Russian Orthodox Church. But it's a really fascinating read. He went from a very kind of like a liberal, just like author. He wrote War and Peace and Anna Karenina, and then wrote A Confession and ended up writing books like The Kingdom of God is Within You, which ended up influencing people like Martin Luther King Jr. and Mahatma Gandhi. So a really interesting person with a really existential kind of point of view. So within this, I'm going to be going through the book of Ecclesiastes, which is a book that I've just kind of been reading. A lot of people view it as a very postmodern book, despite it being so old, and actually consider it one of the first existential books out there. A lot of people don't realize that existentialism was actually birthed out of the church. The Danish philosopher Kierkegaard was the person who actually coined the term existentialism and really focused on it, and he was a theologian. So we're going to be dealing with some pretty heavy topics. So we'll start off in Ecclesiastes and just kind of go over what that says, and then we'll jump into Lamentations and see how we can actually put some of these things into effect in a very chaotic and weird time in this world with the pandemic and everything else that's going on. So the main question in the book of Ecclesiastes is, what does it mean to live well? Ecclesiastes is one of the three books of wisdom that are found in the Old Testament. The first one being Proverbs, which deals with wisdom, but in a very optimistic sense. So if you think of the books as people, the book of Proverbs is a really smart person who's just super happy all of the time. And then you go into Ecclesiastes, which is very much a very common term is life is meaningless. So it's a very hypercritical person who is looking at the world in kind of like a jaded viewpoint. And then the third book is one that I spoke on probably about a month ago now, which was Job. And that is all about vulnerability and suffering and how you can do that. So the book of Ecclesiastes is attributed to King Solomon. They don't have any actual backing to be able to support that, like hard evidence saying, like, hey, written by King Solomon. But through some of the context clues and the dating and stuff, they do put it about that time. So it was King Solomon, and it was actually another writer. So whether he had a scribe who was writing this down as he was going through his philosophical musings, we don't know, or he had a co-author with it. But the main concept of the book of Ecclesiastes is, how do we live in a fallen and corrupt world? So we're going to start off just right at the beginning in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, and we're just going to read that whole chapter real quick. Let me just switch that. There we go. Nope, that's bear with me. Okay, keep in mind, this is a very heavy book. It starts off one way and kind of turns the other at the end, so just bear with me through this. So this is the NIV version. Everything is meaningless. The words of teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What do people gain from all their labors at which they toil under the sun? Generations come and generations go. but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning its course, while streams flow into the sea, and yet the sea is never full. From the place the streams come from, there they return again. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was already here long ago. It was here before our time. No one remembers the former generations, and even those yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them. So that's verses 1 through 11. Again, it's kind of a weird thing to start off with. I think that the author is really just kind of showing you where his mental place is and just being completely vulnerable with himself as with the reader at that time. One of the most interesting things that I've found is that the word for meaningless in Hebrew is hevel. Now, we translate it a lot as meaningless. However, the actual word hevel means breath, smoke, and wind. So we have this idea and this concept that we're looking at, and we count it as meaningless, but the actual Hebrew translation of it says, no, it's a real thing, you can see it, but if you try to grab it, it's no longer there. So it looks palpable, but you can't obtain it. So it's not this thing of that things are meaningless, it's that things are constantly changing, and if you pursue it, it might change a different form or take a different side to it. But it's something that we have a hard time grasping. So the next part of the book goes in and it starts talking about vanity. And basically, vanity in life is ever-changing, and we can pursue things in life that we think will bring us meaning. So this author, we see through this first part, he starts talking about everything that he's tried to do. So it starts off as like, hey, maybe wealth is going to be what gives me meaning in life. And soon he kind of finds that, you know what, this is still pretty hollow. Like, I might be the richest man in all of the world, but there's still something missing in my life, and I'm not finding it. Philip Yancey says this, and this is a really cool quote I've been really enjoying lately, and says that existential despair did not germinate in the hellholes of Auschwitz or Siberia, but rather the cafes of Paris, the coffee shops of Copenhagen, and the luxury palaces of Beverly Hills. So what the author is saying in this first part of the book of Ecclesiastes is that all that life offers us, any sense of meaning and purpose, is meaningless without God. So we can continue to try and push forward and try and make sure that we have everything and all of our needs taken care of, but we're always going to have that emptiness, and something is always going to feel like it's missing when we don't have God. The next part that he talks about is life under the sun. So this is a very common saying throughout the book of Ecclesiastes, where nothing is new under the sun. And basically, a lot of people have taken this to be a very pessimistic view. I would actually argue that it's not a pessimistic view, but I would say that it is more of an accurate perception of how humans view reality. And it just further reveals that emptiness that we can have in our life if we're not pursuing God and having a relationship with God. Moving on, it starts to talk about the value of wisdom. And so if you guys can skip ahead to Ecclesiastes chapter 7. And this is coming off the back of Proverbs. And Proverbs puts a heavy emphasis on wisdom, basically saying, hey, if you can be a wise person and fear the Lord, then you're going to be set for life. And everything's going to work out just fine because you have so much wisdom. Now, the author of Ecclesiastes has a very different approach on it. So Ecclesiastes 7 says, a good name is better than fine perfume, and the day of death better than the day of birth. It is better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting, for death is the destiny of everyone. The living should take this to heart. Frustration is better than laughter, because a sad face is good for the heart. The heart of the wise is in the house of the mourning. but the heart of the fools is in the house of pleasure. It is better to heed the rebuke of a wise person than to listen to the song of fools. Like the crackling of thorns under the pot, so is the laughter of fools. This, too, is meaningless. Extortion turns a wise person into a fool, and a bribe corrupts the heart. The end of matter is better than the beginning, and patience is better than pride. Do not be quickly provoked, and your spirits for anger resides in the lap of fools. Do not say, where were the old days better than these? For it is not wise to ask such questions. Wisdom, like an inheritance, is a good thing, and benefits those who see the sun. Wisdom is a shelter, as money is a shelter. But the advantage of knowledge is this. Wisdom perseveres those who have it. Consider what God has done. Who can straighten what he has made crooked? When times are good, be happy. But when times are bad, consider this. God has made the one as well as the other. Therefore, no one can discover anything about their future. In this meaningless life of mine, I have seen both of these. The righteous perishing in their righteousness, and the wicked living long in their wickedness. Do not be over-righteous, neither be over-wise. Why destroy yourself? Do not be over-wicked, and do not be a fool. Why die before your time? It is good to grasp the one and not let the other go. Whoever fears God will avoid all extremes. Wisdom makes one wise person more powerful than 10 rulers in a city. Indeed, there is no one on earth who is righteous, and no one does what is right and never sins. Do not pay attention to every word people say, or you may hear a servant cursing you. For you know in your heart that many times you yourself have cursed others. All this is tested by wisdom, and I say, I am determined to be wise, but this was beyond me. Whatever exists is far off and most profound. Who can discover it? So I turn my mind to understand, to investigate, to search out wisdom and the scheme of things, to understand the stupidity of wickedness and the madness of folly. I find more bitter than death the woman who is in a snare, whose heart is a trap, and whose hands are chains. The man who pleases God will escape her, but the sinner she will ensnare. Look, says the teacher, this is what I have discovered. Adding one thing to another to discover the scheme of things, while I was searching but not finding, I found one upright man among a thousand, but not one upright woman among them all. This only I have found. God created mankind upright, but they have gone in search of many schemes. So through this, he's putting a realistic value on wisdom. Like, there's a lot to kind of go through and process in this. And like I said, this is a really heavy book, and there's a lot to it. And I could probably do like 5 different talks on this. But I think his overarching statement that he's making is don't put too much faith in wisdom. Because yes, wisdom is an important thing. But unlike what Proverbs says about wisdom, where it says that it's setting you up for success and you're going to be able to do this, the author looks at this in a very pragmatic view and can look at it and go, things are constantly changing in the world, and wisdom isn't going to be the thing that's going to get you over this. In fact, he shows some of the things of having too much wisdom, being too wise, because you become overconfident in yourself. And in your overconfidence, that's when you finally start to sin. But in this, he says, wisdom sets you up for success, but it is up to you to make sure that you are succeeding by not being too confident, too underconfident, wicked, or righteous. And I think that's really interesting because, again, this goes straight into his next topic, which is the sovereignty of God. And basically, he's looking at God and his sovereignty, and he's saying that God has made everything beautiful in his time. Now, within that, that means that we can find beauty in everything. So when things are good, you can find beauty in that. When things are bad, you can also find beauty in that. It's kind of like taking like an Eastern philosophy type of thing. It's that yin and yang. Like, how do you know what is good if you haven't experienced evil? How do you know what love is if you haven't experienced hate? Even in the things that take us down and mess us up and we view as a very negative thing, we can still find beauty in that. I think that it's our jobs to do that, because I feel like God is in everything. So if you can find God, even in the worst circumstance, then you can find beauty and you can find meaning. He says that in Ecclesiastes 3:14, actually. And basically he's saying that we revere God so much because God understands so much more than us. And we can't comprehend exactly what he's doing. And we don't fully grasp his ways. And that goes exactly into Job, when at the end, Job is like lamenting again to God, saying, hey, this is everything that I'm going through. I don't like this. He's being vulnerable. He's having a conversation. He's explaining his position in life. And God comes back to him and goes, you don't understand everything. You have a very strong grasp of what you know, but what you know is about this much, and everything else is about this much. So wisdom helps us plan for contingencies, but it doesn't guarantee us success. Success is something that we have to work towards. Further in that chapter, one of the things that he talks about is that we cannot escape death. Therefore, if we can't escape death, then we need to make sure that we are enjoying life. Because the author is very clear that's life is a gift from God. And if it's a gift, then we must enjoy it. And that's where you get the saying, we need to eat, drink, and be merry. The author of this looks at this and goes, there are so many things that don't matter in life. But if you can find the good things in life, focus on those and then the outpouring of that. Because the fact of the matter is that we are all impermanent. However, God is a very permanent thing. And I feel that God has put eternity on our hearts. And that's why we as humankind are constantly worried about the future, constantly trying to figure out what's going on. Is there life beyond death? What's going on? And I feel like that's part of the thing that God has given us. Because in our impermanence, we're able to rely on the permanent. And so, all we really need to do is try to live life to the fullest. But in doing that, we need to remember God in all things that we do. Chapter 12 really relies heavily on that. One of the things that he talks about is... Let me look it up real quick. One second. Ecclesiastes 12:1 is, remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come and the years approach, when you will say, I find no pleasure. So moving on with that, if we can get in the habit of when we're younger, of remembering God in all things, then when we're older and we start to experience what more people will consider life, when negative things start happening or there's unrest, then it's already become a habit and we can continue to look through that, and it's just setting us up for success rather than for failure. Again, wisdom helps us plan for contingencies, but it's not the end-all cure-all, because we still have to do some work with it. So I think that, one, our meaning can be found in the permanent because we have a desire for the eternity. But also, I think that rather than looking at this thing of living under the sun, spelled S-U-N, we need to look at it as living under the sun, spelled S-O-N. So with that, like, what do we do when things get, like, really weird? What happens when we're facing a global pandemic and our country's kind of going at it with each other, and there's a lot of unknowns? These contingencies that we have so-called planned for are happening, but we can't interact with people. We're stuck at home, and everything seems really uncertain. The suicide rate in the past few months has skyrocketed because people are isolating themselves and aren't getting the things that they need. So I think one of the best things that we can do is we can look at the Book of Lamentations. Aaron, this is for you. the Book of Lamentations was written during and after the siege of Israel by Babylon. You can find that story in 2 Kings. But one of the things that I really, in reading Lamentations, that I discovered is that they take these painful emotions and they make them a good thing. Like, the Bible doesn't discredit them. The Bible, in fact, encourages them, because a lament is a form of poetry. And that specific form of poetry was used for a few different things. It was used as a form of protest. It was used as a form of processing emotions. And it was used as a form of venting anger and dismay. And specifically, the Book of Lamentation is venting its anger and dismay, the ruin caused by people and their sin and their selfishness. So again, it's acknowledging the fact that we do live in a fallen world, and it voices our confusion on why is this happening? Why are we doing this? What's going on? But I think the big thing about this in the Book of Lamentations is it comes from a place of vulnerability, and it's us coming for ourselves and on behalf of others before God. And it forces us to ask questions about God's character. And I think that's an extremely healthy thing to do. I'm of the viewpoint that if you're not questioning things, do you really believe it? Or are you just following what you've been told your entire life? And I think that the Book of Lamentations really hits that home, because it never looks down upon the author for his confusion and for his opinions and for his just heavy, burdened, sad heart. In fact, I think it gives us a place of sacred dignity to human suffering. So the way that the Book of Ecclesiastes is set up is that it's in acrostic poems, or alphabet poems, if you will. So basically, it's each verse starts off with a new letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So in ours, it would be like A, B, C, D. In Hebrew, it's whatever that is. My Hebrew's not super good, so I don't actually know the alphabet. But it's broken down into, I want to say, four or five different books. And each one tells a specific story. The first one is explaining the Lady of Zion and grief and shame. So basically, it takes the story of Jerusalem falling to the Babylonians, and it explains it like it's a funeral or the death of a loved one. So the city has a cycle. The city falling has a psychological impact on everybody in there. And this book really starts to explore that, as if you've lost somebody that you really care about and that you love. And I think in this modern political climate, I feel like we can do the same thing. We can look at everything, the people that are being oppressed, the governments that are happening, whether you are pro them or against them, everything going on in foreign countries and stuff like that, and we can just sit there and we can grieve and we can be honest. And I think that from grief, we can birth change through that. The next part of it talks about the fall of Jerusalem, specifically in regards to God's wrath. Now, I think when people see the word wrath, they think of it as this horrible thing. And I don't think it's necessarily that, because people look at wrath and they think of it as a volatile anger. But you can't look at God's wrath as a volatile anger, because the Bible says that God is slow to anger, but will judge. In fact, it says that something like 20 to 30 times throughout the Bible. The first example of that is in Exodus, as God is making his covenant with the people of Israel. So we can't look at his wrath as just, he's super angry and he's coming in. We have to look at it as justice. When we do something wrong, there's always a consequence to it. Do we have to be happy with that consequence? No. If you read the Book of Lamentations, we find out that the people aren't really happy with the consequence, but the author is going, I understand why we have consequences to things, but can we change this outcome? And further on, you find out that he does. So I think that the poet knows that this was justified, but he is asking for compassion. Moving on, the next one is about, the next poem is called The Suffering One. So it's basically It references a lot of the stuff that happens in Job, and just with that, it's a person coming on behalf from a place of vulnerability and saying, hey, this is where I'm at, this is what's going on. But in this, we find that he lays the soil and he starts planting seeds for hope. Now, a lot of you might be sitting there and you're just kind of going, well, how do you find hope in suffering? I know that that's the thing that is a very common question for me. But the thing is that if we are seeing God in this story being consistent with his judgment, then we have to understand that God is consistent with his promise as well, because he can't be consistent with one without the other. So that means that every promise that we've had from God, everything that God has promised to the Israelite people, that he will not forsake them, he will always be there for them, is still going to come to fruition. Because you can't have A without B. And in that, I find that that really sparks hope. And it's a weird way of looking at it, but I think it's a really beneficial way to look at it. In fact, Lamentations 3, if you guys can open to that, we see that the author of Lamentations says, because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed, for his compassion never fails. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. I say to myself, the Lord is my portion, therefore I will wait for him. And the next chapter is talking about everybody who's going through hurt through this stage. And I think that this is a really important part, especially for this time. Because we see the author who's lamenting on behalf of those who are hurting. He is coming from a place of where he knows where he stands, but he sees that there are other people who are hurting, and he is going on their behalf before God and saying, hey, your people are hurting. We need compassion. And I think that's something that if we could wrap our heads around doing that and saying, hey, there are groups in the world who are hurting. How do we have compassion? How do we show God's compassion to them or for them? I feel like that's when you start to see the tides change. That's when you start to see things differ. And yeah, it's going to be rough, but I think in the long run, it's better. I mean, look what happened in the civil rights movement, you know? Like, it was tough, but things started to change. Do things still need to change? Yeah, there's definitely stuff that we can always improve on and things that we need to work on. But through that, I think that the Book of Lamentations doesn't ask us to deny our emotions. In fact, it tells them that they're valued, that they're important, and that we should voice them. And it's our form of protest. And it rewards us for venting our feelings before God. Because just like I have a friendship with a person, and I sit down and I talk, like say Josh and I are talking, and I'm like, hey, I'm going through a rough time. This is everything that's going on. I'm having a hard time. Not only does that give me solace because I'm able to express stuff rather than keep it in and let it just hold and bottle up until it erupts, but that makes Josh and I closer, because Josh knows where I'm coming from, and I'm being honest and I'm being vulnerable. Vulnerability sparks relationships. Just like a husband and wife lay together, they're naked, they're vulnerable, you know? It increases that intimacy with the person. So I think that Lamentations, be it a really sad book, both these books being very sad and kind of depressive, have an underlying root of hope and positivity in it, and finding the beauty in ashes. So lament, pray, and grieve, because I feel like those are all really important parts of faith. And if anything, it's going to help make your faith stronger. But, yeah, this is, I don't know, it's, I've been reading up on this stuff for a couple days, and it's been super interesting, especially like looking at it through like the lens of like Tolstoy. If you guys haven't read A Confession, I highly recommend it. Keeping in mind it is late 19th century Russian literature, it can be kind of hard to get through. That's one of those books where if you start it, you have to finish it, though, because if you end it, then it's not an existential view. It's a nihilistic view. And it gets very depressive. But that book's had a huge impact on me, and it's really kind of changed how I view things and look at things, and it's been really beneficial for me. Uh-huh. That's pretty much all I had for today. And just kind of talking about, like, acknowledging the fact of, like, we are in a really weird place. Like, we're meeting church online. We can't be in person. A lot of people are going through things. People are stressed out. People don't have work. And I think that a lot of people still try to feel like they have it all together. I think it's okay to acknowledge that, hey, you know, sometimes things are rough, but there's still hope through that. So, like, through this, if there's any way I can encourage people or be hope through that, I'd love to. If we want to open this up for conversation and just kind of get your guys' thoughts on this. Again, these are very, like, philosophical books and stuff like that. There's a lot to unpack, especially in, like, 45 minutes or however long we're on this call for. But I think it's important, and I think it's really cool to acknowledge. And it's not normally something I would kind of willingly go out and try and speak on or teach on. But I don't know. It felt appropriate. So, yeah.
I like it, Jaden. I think I have some things kind of come into mind listening to you, you know, talk about this. Can I read a verse? So, I see you. So hear me out. I don't actually know the context of this, but I heard this particular verse because whenever I've heard it, like, there's something so beautiful about it to me, and it's in Ezekiel, and it says, "I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit in you. I will remove from you your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh," right? And I'm, like, thinking, like, of all the feelings, of all the things that we feel right now with what's happening, right? Injustices and all of the, like, not the new things, but stuff is coming to the surface, and we're all becoming aware of, you know, fill in the blank, right? Like, the issues of injustice towards people, you know, and we get angry, right? And we get frustrated, and but those some feelings, when we grab a hold of them, they harden our hearts. But there's a feeling, grief, like of sadness, that, like, always softens us, like. There's something about weeping. Like, I don't know about you, but, like I remember when all this happened, when stuff started coming to the surface, you know, and, like, I did not want to watch the video of George Floyd getting killed. I didn't want to do it. And I did because something in me told me you need to grieve. And it's hard to grieve being disconnected. Right? Grief is such a connecting emotion. Like you were saying, like, it draws you close to somebody. Like, if you actually grieve with somebody, there's a deeper connection that happens in that than when you rejoice, even. Like, it's something deeper. And I remember watching the video, and it was the only thing that could, like, a couple times I watched it, and I could grieve a little bit, you know, not just for him, but for, like, all of the other people that have not been seen or heard, you know, but I yet to grieve. Like, I still yet to grieve, because it's not easy. And, like, there's actually, like, an intentional thing of stepping into it. So I think Lamentations is, like, I'm going to choose grief. Like, I think we need to actually choose sorrow and grief. And we're so afraid that it's going to disable us, but I think it's actually what makes our hearts soft. And that's a powerful thing. It sounds like a weak thing, but it's like putting a soft heart in the hands of God, you know, like what he calls himself a potter, you know? So it's like, what good is stone in the hands of a potter, but clay in the hands of a potter, right? And I think that there are ways that we need to become soft. And I think that's the power of Lamentations, you know? Like, to be able to read through and be able to connect and go, like, this sounds all jacked up. And to, like, stir up the emotions, like, anyways, I like it, Chayton. I think it's good, you know?
I appreciate it. I don't know if you said it as a joke when you were like, you should talk on Lamentations.
Totally did. It was a joke.
Oh, well, look what you did now.
I had no idea. I was just like thinking to myself, you said, well, what? I don't remember that conversation started, but I was like, you know, you should teach on. And then I didn't know what to do, and you're all, what? And I'm all, and I thought about it, I'm all, I just thought about probably the hardest thing to teach on.
Well, it worked.
Yeah. It's, I'm sure other people have thoughts and stuff, but I think we need a soft heart. And I don't think it happens by chance. We actually have to be open to it. And sometimes we have to actually step into it. Like, write the poems, write the songs, you know what I mean? Like, find the place that you can weep and stay there on your knees. Don't start to cry and run, you know? Like, I was thinking about, have you ever read the book Crossing the Switchblade? Anybody know what I'm talking about? I'm trying to remember his name. It's the book written about a preacher from somewhere in the Midwest, and this was back in like the 60s or something. And the book is his story, and he's a pastor in some Midwest town. He's got this little church, and it's like really beautiful. And he opens a paper one day, and he reads about these kids in New York City, and they're like, he's reading about like these 10-year-olds and 12-year-olds that are like murderers and thieves, you know, like it's like talking about the gangs in New York, but like they're children. And it says that he spends like 3 solid days weeping. Like he basically told his wife, he's like, I'm going to be in my office. And she would come and bring him water to drink. But like he chose to stay there and weep. And then he goes to New York, this Midwestern white preacher goes to New York to minister to like all of these like underclass, like kids that are like hardened, you know? And honestly, if you've never read the book, The Cross and the Switchblade, like it's way powerful. Like he puts his life on the line. We're supposed to weep. And I think we need to choose it because we're actually going to, like, sometimes we feel lost and we're like, I need direction. God, show me where to go. He's all, find a place to weep. You want to know what's next? Slow down long enough to feel my heart. You know, like we want to learn the words. We want to learn the power. We want to learn this and that and the other. And like, what more powerful than to have God's heart of compassion? You know?
Like, I feel like that ties in with, like, the whole, like, Garden of Gethsemane.
Yep. Gethsemane. How do you say it?
Gethsemane. Why can't I say this? Josh, you want to say it? You can say it.
Don't shake your head in judgment, Josh. Unmute and say it.
Gethsemane. I don't know.
It's not that easy.
Gethsemane.
There we go, that one. But it's like, it talks about like Jesus like going out and praying, and he's in that solitude, you know, and he's being vulnerable. He's like, if there's any other way, take this cup from me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, and he's left.
That's, that's probably been my favorite part of the Bible for like 3 years now.
Yeah. Maybe because it's the shortest verse and it's easy to memorize.
I don't have my attention span, you know, it's really lacking. And so